Mastery and coaching from five perspectives: an educator, an ethicist, an administrator, a researcher, and a coach. Panel discussion at the 2016 National Coaching Conference in Seattle, Washington. Serving in the role as the researcher on the panel, Dr. Wade Gilbert.
One of the characteristics I see with great coaches is they're really masterful coaches. They just love to learn. It's embedded in who they are. It's not an act. They're not mandated to do things. They're very proactive. And I'll give you an example of that. I work with and coach from little kids to Olympic and pro. And I was giving a session, teaching a class for the U.S. Olympic Committee with a room full of coaches. And one of the coaches in the room, the most successful coach in the room, was Karish Karai. And it was a week after they had just won their first ever world championship. And I grew up watching him play. He's considered the greatest volleyball player of all time. And he's sitting there taking notes. I think he was writing something down in those books. And then, anyways, after the session, to give you an example of mastery in action, so the most accomplished person in the room, most decorated athlete, most accomplished coach, first person in line to ask questions with his notepad and his pen. You send me that reference. What was that article you mentioned? The most successful one is the first one in line to get better, to ask questions. And I remember Coach Whitten used to say, too, you can learn from everyone. And I distinctly remember driving him home one time from an event at UCLA. And we're on 405 if you live in LA. And here I am, I'm a young guy, and I'm driving. I got John Whitten next to me, driving down the freeway, and I'm vaguely listening to him because I'm trying not to be the guy who becomes known as the one who killed Coach Wooden on the freeway. So I got, death grip on the wheel, and at one point I realized, oh man, I got to get over. So I crossed over the carpool lanes, and he grabbed my arm and started to teach me, I have to do that, and what you just did there, and I'm thinking, I just want to make sure I get you safely home. But for him, again, mastery was always learning and teaching. So that car was a classroom, just another classroom. And he was asking me questions the whole way back, too. And he didn't, what could I teach him? But in his mind, everyone is a teacher. And there's always an opportunity to learn. And so I see that as a great hallmark of coaches who really live that mastery approach. From a research perspective, because this is, part of my role up here, I might equate mastery to growth mindset, which you hear a lot about with Carol Dweck, and there's a group in Australia who's starting to work with her now to try and develop a growth mindset or mastery coaching behavior profile. So if we wanted to actually go out and observe coaches in action, what do mastery behaviors look like? So we're starting to do that a little bit. But I really think also you can look at coaches who really are take a mastery orientation. I would consider them environmental engineers. This is what I see with the best around the world. When I get to talk to these kinds of people, they really focus on creating the right environment. So it's not a behavior, it's not a tactic or a strategy. It's the type of environment that they create which promotes and allows mastery to flourish. And again, going back to Karish Karai, he said one of the things that was really different for him when he took over the program, it was only 2 years since they took over and they won the world championship. He said if you came to one of the first practices, you would notice world's best athletes trying really hard to not make mistakes. So they were really focused on proving their ability, which would be kind of an entity view if you look into the theories of ability and mastery. He said, I had to shift that to an environment, so I had to change that environment from going where athletes focused on improving their ability to focusing on improving their ability. So he wrote on the board, ugly practices. He said, if you come and watch one of our practices, best team in the world, best athletes in the world, it will look awful. It will look ugly. And I had to change the environment and get that into their mindset that the only way for us to be the best, stay the best, continue to be the best, is to be willing to be vulnerable and make mistakes and look like fools in practice. I want you out here being vulnerable and being comfortable with that. That takes a special kind of coach. Because why am I going to be vulnerable and willing to make mistakes if I'm going to get yelled at or benched or lose my spot? So it's developing an environment of trust and support. So you set those boundaries and you create create that environment, and you support them in their willingness to be vulnerable.
All right, thoughts on increasing mastery. Again, what I've seen in the research and the work that I do with coaches, part of that is building your network. So an activity I do quite often in workshops, I'll have coaches, I'll show them a slide with an athlete in the center of the slide. And then it's like a wheel with spokes. And you see all the support. I get them to fill in, you know, all the people that support an athlete's development. Athletic trainers, strengths coach, nutritionist, sports psychology, coaches, assistant coaches, peers, you know, friends. This huge support network, academic tutors, this huge support network all around. Their whole focus is developing this person in the center of this athlete. I give them another sheet and I say, write your name in the center of the sheet. Fill in the bubbles around your development. Who's on your team? It's like, who's in, what's in your wallet, right? Who's on your team? Can you... you know, in the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes, can you identify 10 people that are on your team? They're people that you trust, that build you up, that nourish you, that help you get better, that push you, that stretch you. And that's hard. Even I've been with Olympic coaches, some get 3 or 4 names in there. I'm going to be the best in the world. You've got 3 people you can trust and really work to on a regular basis. And I had a conversation with a commissioner of one of the NCAA leads recently, and he said, Wade, the biggest thing we see now, and I've talked to all these other commissioners, within 2 years of hiring a coach at the NCAA level, they're either on sleeping pills, anti-anxiety medication, broken relationships, physical disorders, and ill. So because they're isolated, we isolate them. Even in an athletics department, they don't talk to each other, they don't share things. They're traveling, they're all over the place, they're competing for resources. So again, how can you create the environment to nourish your... Well, it's part of who we are. It's one of our basic human needs, is to want to get better confidence and grow. And curious by nature, right? So how can we build that environment around us? And if you don't have it, how can we create it? So we just finished a study with another college in the U.S., and at this particular college, the coaches took upon themselves, the women coaches, and they created what they call the loop group. So, you know, stay in the loop. So they created a loop group. It wasn't mandated, and it wasn't compensated. It was just a formal way for them to meet on a regular basis. They had an agenda, and there was time to share, debrief, grow, share resources. So that's really important that we're able to do that. Some other things that we mentioned related to that. You need to be selfish, right? So as a coach, your work is never done. You will never finish. And coaches drive themselves into the ground. And it's part of our Western mentality. It's not like that in other parts of the world. My wife's from the Caribbean. I remember distinctly visiting there one time, and nobody wears a watch. Nobody's, you know, I'll meet you sometime. I mean, it's an island where you're going. I'll find you eventually, right? But here's, if you're on time, you're late, right? And we just drive, 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 drive. So how can we be more kind to ourselves, you know, and build in time to be... You can't serve others if you're not healthy, right? So how can... You have to make time to exercise and to have social time. It's not... You're not losing ground. You're not falling behind. You're nourishing your energy, right? And I read something in Inc. magazine, I think it was recently, and they looked at... did a little study on what the best leaders do, some of the strategies. Mastery and nourishment, and I like this idea. They start the day on offense, and then they get to defense. And most of us start on defense. You get up, check your texts, check your emails. So right away you're on defense and serving other people, right? And then you get more anxious because you get to go all day and say, "Oh, I didn't work on that book or that article, or I didn't phone that friend, or I didn't follow up on this." So you're playing defense all day, and you will never catch up as a coach. So they built in these great leaders. They built in. It's 20 minutes, 15, 30, whatever it is. That's the first thing you do when you wake up. You be selfish. You do something for yourself. You work on something that's important to you. You're not finishing it, but you're working. You're putting in some time in it over time. A couple of final thoughts and some anecdotes and tools. I'll throw it in here 3 or 4 minutes. I was just at an event in Houston last week, and I heard a story about the current head coach of the Mexican national soccer team. Probably not as good as it was last week before they lost 7-0 in Chile. Anyway, it's a fun story. So this is a guy that had no background, no strong background in soccer, but he, through his career, he wanted to become a high-level coach. And so he did everything right to create opportunities to get better and to put himself in a position to have that ultimate opportunity. So one story that really stuck out with me, he was a graduate student in England. At one point, he went over there to get better, to learn about coaching, the science of coaching. And he, I believe it was Manchester City, the football team and soccer team. And he wanted to go out and observe and learn as much as he could. So he went out to the training stadium, and he couldn't get in, of course, because it was closed practices. But he wanted to see what the best in the world do. And he had no way of doing that. But he noticed across the street from the training, there were what, the row of houses. And some of them were two stories high. Just enough from the second floor, you could see over the fence into the training stadium. So he went over to knock, just knocked on a door, until he found a house that was willing to rent out a room on the second floor. And that's where he rented the room, and he lived there for a full semester in grad school. He'd rush home from school every day, sit by the window with his notepad, and take notes. And I did a little study with my graduate students many years ago, where I had each of them go out and identify very successful people, all domains, art, music, science, history, sport, and see if we could find some common themes, a little article about it, and common elements of expertise and talent across these different fields. And one of them was what we call opportunity. But the best make and notice opportunities. So it's not just having opportunity, they make opportunities. The soccer coach made an opportunity, right? Steven Spielberg, I don't know if you know that story, but he actually went into, I believe it was Universal Studios every day when he was young. He wanted to be around movie making, but he had no business being there at the time. So he would show up in a suit, in a briefcase, and no job. And nobody would question him because he looked official, and he would go into a janitor's closet and hang out on the lot and watch movie making. So making opportunity. And you see that with the best, taking initiative. Another thing that I would suggest is being systematic with your reflection, because all coaches think about coaching, but do you really use that as an opportunity to get better? Do you maximize that natural inclination? So one thing that I found great success with all of the coaches, we do reflection cards. And it started out, it's just an index card, but you can digitize it. But it gets people to focus on things that matter. Because your mind is racing all over the place all day. You're putting out fires, thinking of stuff. But you're not really getting better. You're doing, but you're not getting better. So these reflection cards, after every event, practice, competition, coaches take it 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and now we have their athletes doing it too, and the coaches get to see that. And they reflect as prompts. So they're not writing journals. They're not just free-form reflecting. We identify at the beginning of the year with every coach, every sport, what are the things that matter that will put you and your team in a position, your athlete in a position to succeed. Football might be, you know, if we're doing these seven things in a game, we're going to win. Remember our baseball coach at Fresno State, the national champion a few years ago. And he spent, as a graduate student, he spent many years studying the success of a baseball game. He came up with five factors, and with each one, increased the percentage of the winning by 20%. Those are the five things that matter to winning a baseball game. I'm going to get really good at teaching those five things and having my players execute those five things. So they reflect on the things that matter, and then it gives them a prompt to move forward. Always next best step, closing gaps. So what are the things that matter? How do we do on those things today? What's the next best step to closing the gap? We don't really do goal setting anymore. Goal is get better today. That's the goal. Get better today, get better today, get better today. Seems simple, but you get away from it. And you see the best companies in the world do the same thing. That thing I'll mention related to that, creating an environment for yourself to get better and to get feedback. You know, as coaches, we're very competitive by nature, but also we'll put in environments that are not conducive to sharing and learning and growing together. Right? It's about hoarding information, hoarding knowledge. And there was a league in a baseball league in Canada that experimented with this, great success, but it fell apart because the leader left somewhere else. But what they did in this league, this was high competitive league, 15, 16-year-olds, many went into college, some went to Major League Baseball. So it's competitive, it's still very competitive. but what they did in every game. If you did ask, if you're coaching in this league, every athlete in this league is one of ours. We're all coaching together to build up the collective capacity of the athletes in this league. So that means if I have a coach on my staff who's a phenomenal pitching coach, he's going to go around to the other practices and periodically coach their pitchers. Yeah, that may mean losing a game, but it's not about me winning a game. It's about developing these players and raising the whole ship. Right? In every game, they also, any coach can stop the game after a play and replay it. And you may have heard of this in some other places where they do replay scrimmages. So if I see an error, instead of yelling at the kid or making a note to deal with it later, we stop it. The coaches together go out and say, how could we have done this better? The top two players, they reset. They do it again. It's about learning. It's about development. It's about all of us getting better. They still compete. So there's ways to do that.